Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. There is a magic, certainly, to how the brain works. But for our brains, there is also something amazing, unbelievable even, about magic itself. What does it tell us about the brain that fortune tellers are able to sense the future, or that a sleight-of-hand card trick can be so convincing and perplexing? My guest has written about that intersection between science and magic. Alex Stone is the author of Fooling Houdini: Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. Alex Stone, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to first jump right into an experiment that you talk about in the book. It's a 1948 experiment by a psychologist named Bertram Fohrer, and he's trying to sort of show how accurate personality tests can be. And how does he set up this experiment?
So Bertram Fohrer gave a group of students a personality assessment called the Diagnostic Interest Blank. And it was like a personality measuring tool, basically. It was a series of questions. And a week later, he gave each of the students personality readings, you know, descriptions that were purportedly based on the results of this test. And then he had the students rate on a scale of 0 to 5 how accurately they felt the descriptions captured their own personality. And the average came out to be about 4.3, which meant, so 0 being not very accurate, 5 being very accurate, which meant that most of the students thought that he nailed it, that the personality descriptions uniquely captured who they were. They were very lifelike portraits.
Right, very accurate personality tests.
Yeah, and they were quoted as saying things like, got me exactly, you know, things like that. But the curious thing is that, I mean, it would seem from this result that the diagnostic interest blank was, in fact, a very sharp tool. But the secret was that he never actually used it. He threw it in the trash. And he gave all the students identical personality descriptions lifted from a Newsstand astrology book. This experiment has been repeated many times, and the average always hovers around 4.3. And they've since given a name to this phenomenon. They call it the Barnum effect, after P.T. Barnum's famous statement, "There's something for everyone."
Okay, so this is really interesting. So you have almost 40 people, very different personalities. How do you explain the fact that everybody gets the same personality description and they all say, yep, that's me, right? That really describes me, even though quite clearly in a group of 39, there's got to be a broad spectrum of personalities.
Yeah, it basically is a very universal cognitive bias. You know, our human brain is freighted with all these biases, all these cognitive biases. One of them is what's known as confirmation bias, which is that our brains tend to highlight the things that confirm our beliefs and the things that we get right, the things that are correct, and sort of edit out the things that are wrong. So in these personality descriptions, people very much tend to remember and focus on the things that are accurate and then ignore the things that aren't. Also, there's just this idea that by giving them information, there's the assumption that, you know, that what's coming back to you is based on that information. So that's just a bit of a sleight of hand there. In fact, they did a cool version of this experiment where they had a mock astrologer give people readings. And they divided them into three groups. One group gave the astrologer no information about themselves. The other group gave them, I think, just the month or the year in which they were born. And then the third group gave them their exact birth date. And all the people were then given identical readings and asked again to rate the accuracy. And the group that gave no information rated it below a 4. So accurate, but not super accurate. The group that had given just one bit of information, such as the month of their birth, rated it around a 4. And then the group that had given their birth date gave it a higher 4.27 or something, which was remarkable because it suggested that the accuracy of the reading was a function not of what the astrologer told the subjects, but what the subjects told the astrologer.
Right. It's like your psychological investment that you've put in. If it's higher, you expect more out of it. To segue into magic, you say, you know, every horoscope writer, every palm reader, every fortune teller knows this. And here is this whole branch, this whole area of magic where people are really successful and, you know, they have a lot of clients.
Yeah, sure. It's great. I mean, a lot of magicians historically have gone into this territory because it's very lucrative and it's a form of magic. And there's a lot. I mean, there's a million tricks and techniques out there. Exploiting this basic human bias is the beginning of it and it's foundational. But it's also, you know, there's all these tricks on how to secretly extract information from people. And there's all these techniques on how to word things and make statements so that people tend to believe them, which is basically the basis of what's known as cold reading. Cold reading is when you basically appear to know things about a person that you couldn't possibly know. And it's the basis of all psychic readings. And, you know, if you want to learn about these things, you read magic books and books by magicians and con artists. And there's a lot of confessions of people who made their money doing this kind of thing and then felt bad about it or whatever. And, you know, even, you know, fake psychics and fake mediums. Houdini even, for example, started out doing psychic fake offering to contact dead relatives and whatnot. And later on, he felt very bad about this. So he spent much of his life crusading against spirit mediums. And yeah, so this is a branch of magic that fits into what's known as mentalism. And there are a lot of mentalists who perform, you know, as theatrical entertainers, and they don't really claim to have supernatural powers. A lot of them sort of tread the line. They say, oh, it's psychology or whatnot. And then there are the people, you know, who actually try to convince others that they have these supernatural powers, that they can actually contact your dead relatives or read minds or predict the future. And these people are basically magicians slash con artists who use the techniques of deception familiar to many magicians and conjurers to steal money from people, to exploit them, to instill false belief systems.
Right. You kind of divide it into honest liars, which is an interesting term. And then the people who really try to profit off of grief and faith and that kind of thing. And there are high profile people you would consider in the latter category.
Oh, definitely. I mean, and any magician or mentalist sort of knows this, right? These people are frauds. And it's in some ways, I think it behooves magicians who are familiar with these techniques or scientists or anyone to expose them, you know, and some people have taken people like James Randi and whatnot. There's a whole skeptics movement and magicians. It's interesting because magic for centuries, I mean, going back centuries, has been a tool for popular skepticism and secularism, and magicians have been debunking fake psychics and spiritualists. I mean, the first English manual on sleight of hand is this very old book called The Discovery of Witchcraft, which was actually written as to debunk witchcraft, to protect people who were accused of witchcraft from, you know, being burned at the stake. And King James hated the book. He ordered it burned, but it survived. And it exposed the dark arts by saying, look, it's just a trick. So, you know, you have this whole tradition of magicians on one end of the spectrum using magic to debunk this stuff, and then other not-so-savory characters using the techniques of deception to trick people. And I think you can roughly divide it into this honest, dishonest liar category, because magicians lie all the time in their acts. I mean, magic is like essentially a form of lying for entertainment, but they don't lie about the fact that they're magicians, whereas other people who use these techniques often do. And I think that's, well, that's not a good thing in general. They're con artists, you know? But unlike the people doing the three-card Monty on the street, where everyone sort of knows they're con artists, these guys, I think they're even worse because people think they're legit.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Innovation Hub, and I'm talking with Alex Stone, author of Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. And Alex Stone, you say that religion has aspects of magic in it as well, and there may be proof even that Jesus studied magic.
Yeah, get ready for the letters now. We welcome your letters.
I'm ready.
Yeah, I mean, this is not my theory. This is actually a theory that was proposed by a very well-respected biblical scholar by the name of Morton Smith, who was at Columbia. And he discovered some of these non-synoptic gospels, you know, that didn't make it in the final cut when they put together the Bible, you know, because there were lots of gospels and competing views of Christianity. But a lot of people don't realize that, you know, before the church and the Council of Nicaea, and they basically put together what we now know as the Bible, there were all these. Christianity was much more diverse. It was viewed as a magical religion, as a pagan religion. It borrowed a lot of pagan, you know, Easter is a pagan holiday. The you know, Sabbath is, you know, all that stuff is co-opted from past religions. In any case, he had this theory, Morton Smith, that Jesus was a magician, and he trained with magicians in Egypt during the 18 years that are unaccounted for in the Gospels. You know, there's an 18-year period in Jesus' life that's just a blank. And that the miracles, the classic miracles, which made Jesus famous in his own lifetime, Jesus was known as a miracle worker. That was what made him famous. That's what attracted followers and ultimately led to his execution. And some of these miracles were framed as fulfillments of Hebrew prophecies. In any case, his claim is that, look, water into wine, levitations, multiplying loaves, these are tricks. Anyone can do these. These are magic tricks. And maybe later on they were sort of, you know, because the Gospels were obviously were written after Jesus' death by other people, so they were, you know, viewed through the eyes of true believers or reconfigured. But it makes a lot of sense, and they even recently discovered a shard of pottery in the Gulf of Alexandria. It was a marine archaeologist discovered it, and they found it. They think it's one of the first references, written references to Jesus, and on it it says Christ the magician.
So now, if I went to Vegas and, you know, started finding magicians, which I know Vegas is a real mecca for magicians, and we talked about those three instances of what you called magic there, water into wine, levitation, and multiplying loaves of bread, could we find people who could do those things?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, if you think about it, you can go to a magic – you don't even have to go to Vegas. Go to a magic store. These are common magic tropes, right? Levitating things. I mean, you can buy a pitcher that changes water into wine. Water spouters, these people that would spit water and wine out. Those are ancient sort of carnivalesque type magic acts. Even types of resurrections can be affected through various means, you know, slow your heart rate. There's all kinds of things you can do. So, yeah, I mean, these tricks – I mean, didn't Chris Angel walk on water recently?
I think you may, yeah.
Again, you have to remember that the Gospels were not, they were written by other people. So, you know, another explanation is that they just, you know, made it up. But I think it's probably not quite like that. Even before Jesus, I mean, there's stories of priests using, you know, turbines to power open the doors of the temple when the flames were on the altar and using, you know, statues that spouted wine. These parlor tricks meant to instill fear and awe in the masses. So the idea of using conjuring tricks to, and, you know, Joseph Smith, the guy who founded Mormonism, you know, he started out as a con artist. He started out as a guy who said he could locate gold and silver through, you know, a dowser, that's what it's called. And, you know, he would palm a piece of gold and plant it in the trawl. And he made a lot of money and got a really healthy rap sheet before, you know, deciding he could make more money in the religious business, in the religion business. So, you know, a lot of religious figures used these tricks to attract followers and make money.
And people have been impressed, you say, for a long time, not just sort of lay people, but like Thomas Edison was floored by a lot of the sort of magic tricks that people could do, even though you think, oh, here's somebody who's really based in science and should, not believe any of this stuff. But he was really impressed.
And the history of science is filled with accounts of scientists being duped by magicians. One of the most famous ones is Project Alpha, which was a hoax basically concocted by James Randi, where he hired these two guys, these two mentalists, magicians, experts in like bending metal. And they convinced an entire lab of scientists. It was a $500,000 facility that was overseen by the McDonnell Douglas, that was funded by the McDonnell Douglas Corporation and overseen by a physicist. And they convinced all of them that they could bend spoons and keys and stuff with their mind. And then later they exposed it as a hoax. But this is just one of, you know, many instances in which scientists have been duped by these tricks. And I think there's a, I like this saying by a British mentalist, Ian Rowland. He says, a rocket scientist can be fooled by a deceiver because she knows about rocket science and not deception.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think scientists often are susceptible to this because they don't expect to be tricked in this way. And they expect things to conform to certain rational rules. And they, I don't know, or maybe they're just, there are a lot of bad scientists out there. That might just be it as well.
I'm talking with Alex Stone, and he's written the book Fooling Houdini. So one really interesting aspect of your life is that you are between these two worlds, flying to Vegas on the weekends while you're getting a PhD in physics at Columbia. And I'm wondering, how did you get interested in magic in the first place?
Well, I was 5 when my dad bought me a magic kit. I think like a lot of people, you know, he bought me one of these kids' kits. It was like, you know, had a little goblet with the ball that you could make disappear and a little coin box. And
yeah, I had one of those. I had one of those.
Yeah.
I remember.
My first show, my first gig was my own 6th birthday party, which was actually a disaster. It went terribly. It heckled me. It was merciless. And But then I don't know, I kept with it, and I missed that developmental stage when you abandon these adolescent hobbies, and I kept with it. And part of it was because my dad was really into it. He was a scientist, and I don't know, he didn't really do sports, or we didn't go camping, but magic was kind of this thing that we bonded over. He'd take me to the magic store on weekends. And I continued that ritual when I moved to New York. That's when I sort of discovered this remarkable subculture of people that were obsessed with magic. And this was a world of secrecy and deceptions. There were these societies and these bizarre rituals and schools and even tournaments. There's even a magic Olympics that happens every 3 years. And it actually just took place in England this summer, right before the non-magical Olympics. So this is a whole world that most people have never seen, never know exists, and it's filled with creative and brilliant people, and magic, I realized, was almost going through a renaissance. There were all these new moves and tricks being invented and magicians fooling each other. So that was really cool. I got really into that world. And then I began to realize that there were all these really fascinating connections between magic and science. Magic is all about toying with the limits of perception, gaming the human mind. And so you learn a lot about how the mind works by studying the way that magic tricks us into seeing things that aren't real. And I'm not the first person to come up with this. Scientists have been using the techniques of magic to study the human brain. And in recent years, they've even teamed up with magicians to try to model experimentally what these masters of illusion seem to understand intuitively about the human brain. Then there are also connections to mathematics and physics and other things. And so Fooling Houdini is partly a story of this subculture, partly a memoir of my own fascination with magic. But in the end, it's an attempt to get at some more fundamental human questions that arise when you investigate magic and how it affects the brain. Things like, you know, how much of our world do we consciously take in? How much faith can we have in our memories? What are the effects of secrecy on our relationships, on our lives? Why do we enjoy being deceived and at times in deceiving others? Why do people seem programmed to believe in the supernatural? These are all basic human questions that affect us in our daily lives and our behavior and how we see the world. And I think ultimately that's what I'm trying to get at, is to say, well, look, there's this whole side of magic that most people aren't familiar with. And not only that, but we learn a lot about what it means to be human by looking at something that in a way seems kind of esoteric.
Let's universal. Talk about one of those things, which is secrecy, which you talk a little bit about in the book. There would really be no magic tricks, right, if there weren't secrecy. The whole thing is premised on secrets. But how do secrets also become part of our daily lives? How important are they in shaping our behavior?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, everybody keeps secrets. And, you know, some people have theorized that different languages were created to keep secrets. I don't know if that's true, but everybody keeps secrets. Half of people keep secrets from their therapists. And remarkably, there's a lot of research in this. They even have a thing called the self-concealment score, which is basically like a secrecy IQ. It's, everything's open to bank vault. And it turns out that people who have a very high self-concealment score, people who keep a lot of things inside, get sick more. They're physically more stressed out. They get more headaches. They even did a study of a cohort of HIV-positive gay men and found that those who were in the closet had a less favorable prognosis and the disease evolved more quickly than those who were out of the closet, which is another really good reason why don't ask, don't tell was a horrible, horrible policy.
So it sort of takes energy to keep a secret. Part of your mental and physical.
It's stressful.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, holding a secret in an interview will set off a polygraph. It's kind of like lying. And even just writing a secret trauma on a piece of paper and then burning it has been found to reap some psychological and physical rewards. And then there's the other side of secrecy, too, which is that in the same way that some people, most people enjoy deceiving others on some level, keeping a secret can, say, enhance desire. In this one really hilarious study, a professor had strangers play footsie under a table, and some of them did it in secret and some did it openly and some not at all. And they found that afterwards, the ones who had done it in secrecy were more attracted to each other than the ones who had done it openly or not at all. And this may help explain why there's such high rates of infidelity in marriages. You know, more than a third of marriages are thought to have, you know, some infidelities. And it might be because, well, the secrecy, the planning, the deception in and of itself heightens desire, much in the way that parental restrictions are known to enhance the allure of romantic relationships, the so-called Romeo and Juliet effect. So there's all this way in which secrecy influences our lives and our relationships to people. And, you know, magic, like you said, is rooted in secrecy. And granted, like holding on to a secret trauma is not the same as holding on to a secret in magic. But I think there is a lot to be learned from studying how secrets work in magic because, well, it sets up a peculiar relationship between the audience and the magician. Magic is really the only art that requires that kind of blanket ignorance from the spectator. There's nothing really really like that. I mean, movies aren't really like that. No one cares if you watch a behind the scenes. You know, if people don't want to read the spoilers, they don't read the spoilers. And I think it sets up a tension because as a magician, you are supposed to deceive and deliberately withhold information from the very people whose approval you seek to win. And that's difficult. And there's almost an antagonistic kind of dynamic set up there.
Well, and it also explains in some ways the lure of the magician yes. subculture, which before I read your book, I had no idea existed. But you talk yes. about there's sort of all these secret meetings in New York where you live. And there's, you know, this guy who hangs out in a pizza parlor all the time. Mm-hmm. And if you sort of know where these meetings are, you get to be part of this
sure.
really secret and kind of elite subculture.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, there's a pleasure, right? A joy in being part of something secret. And that explains, you know, not just magic, but, you know, why people join clubs and why people, you know, and also, again, the secret affairs, the secrets that people keep from each other. There's it's a power dynamic in some ways, you know. Secrecy is a way to establish control. And it's important, and it's not just a bad thing. You know, learning to keep secrets is vital to our development, to our protection, to protecting ourselves. But I think in magic, that's right. It really does lend an allure. And there are a lot of magicians who take this very seriously. And that's why you've got this magician's oath. It's a real thing, the magician's code. All neophytes in the magic societies are required to swear a solemn oath of secrecy. And violating it, as I learned the hard way, can lead you to be expelled from these societies. So it's very interesting. Yeah.
Well, you know, you also talk about how some of the people who keep these secrets we wouldn't even think of as magicians. So, for example, you go to downtown New York or downtown a lot of other places, and you see people doing what many people do, these three-card Monty tricks, right? So
yeah.
you're supposed to pick a card and figure out where the little whatever
yeah,
it is, a green pea or so, what exactly, something
yep.
is hidden. I know that you actually approach some of these sort of, we think of them as con artists, right? But you actually,
no, they are. I mean,
right,
yeah.
approach some of these people and said that you wanted to be in on their trick. You were a magician too.
Yeah.
They were reluctant. But how does this three-card Monty trick work?
Well, it's a con, but it is a magic trick. It relies on sleight of hand and patter. And it's really interesting because the three-card Monty it's really one of the oldest tricks in the book. In fact, the history of it is remarkable. It really funded the first criminal empires in America. I mean, the game itself goes back to probably the 15th century and the Caucasus and, you know, gypsies and who spread across Europe. But in America, people made millions of dollars. I mean, this one crew aboard the Mississippi riverboats made what today would be $25 million in a few years just doing the Monty. And it really, like I said, it funded the ancestors of the mafia. In fact, the first dollar store was actually a front for the three-card Monty. These days, it still works, though, and it's incredible. A lot of people think it's just one guy, but it's actually a crew of people, usually 6 to 8 people. You've got some wall man looking out for cops on the flanks, and then a bunch of the shills, which are the Confederates, who play the game in different ways. And it's very powerful. You see, people think that it works, you know, because the sucker, the mark, doesn't realize it's a scam, but that's not true, actually. The three-card Monty works by convincing the sucker that it's a scam and then also further convincing him that he can write himself into it. And so what'll happen is, you know, one shill will bet and win, another shill will bet and lose in a very silly, obvious way that the mark sees, you know, he could have done that, he could have won. Then maybe the operator, the guy who's shuffling the cards, will turn his head and one of the shills will cheat by showing where the ace or queen is and win. Then he'll try to cheat again, but the operator will spot him. And when the cheater turns away, the operator will switch the cards, so the cheater will lose. So the sucker is watching all of this and he thinks, oh, and maybe the operator will throw out a veiled insult, you know, an ego hook, as it's known, just to bait him, much like a used car salesman might do. And by this point, the sucker's, oh my goodness, this is everyone's cheating everyone. There's no honor among thieves. And I've seen people lose hundreds and hundreds of dollars. I mean, these guys make tons of money. It's a remarkable. And I think ultimately the reason it works so well, given that it's a very rudimentary con, is that it really does tap in, much like the mentalism stuff, into these very basic human fallacies. You know, it has the confidence artist, you know, has, there's a reason why they're the only criminals we refer to as artists. They have this remarkable ability to safecrack our insecurities and stoke our greed and lockpick that little kernel of avarice that's in everyone. And I think you see this, it's the same psychology that you'll see, you know, in the Nigerian bank scam, which costs Americans $100 million a year, Bernie Madoff's, you know, billion-dollar Ponzi scheme, or on the campaign trail, you know, these same psychological sleights of hand, the bait and switch, the misdirection that you see all the time. And I think the same psychology, the same architecture is kind of used in all sorts of cons. Wall Street.
I want to get into some of those cons. Yeah. But first, I just want to say that the three-card Monty, you say, people, that crew, which you think, these are sort of petty criminals, they can make $10,000 in cash over the course of an afternoon. $10,000 in an afternoon, that's a pretty good take.
I mean, that's an estimate, granted, but, you know, what I've seen is, you know, usually you've got two or three crews working a couple blocks, and they'll work an afternoon, usually on the weekends when there's tons of people. And I've seen them, I've watched them a lot, and I've seen, you know, minimum bets $100. I've seen people lose as much as $500. And so, you know, maybe it's not $10,000 every day, maybe it's $5,000, but it seems like easily, you know, because I'll watch them an hour and I'll see them rake in, you know, $500, and that's just one crew, and there's several of them. So, yeah, it's a remarkably efficient small business. I've heard that some of the, you know, group leaders provide free transportation to their employees. And, you know, these are tough guys. You know, they're often, you know, learn their trade in Rikers. But I have to confess a certain guilty respect for them because, well, it's one thing to, you know, hold a person up at gunpoint or I don't know, pull a Ponzi scheme or steal someone's money from behind a desk. But to get someone on the street that you've never met to part with their money and then not press charges does require a certain deft touch, you know?
So let's take that larger and look at, like, Ponzi schemes and Bernie Madoff. So these people obviously stole a lot more than $10,000. Yeah. So I wonder, sort of, what do they know? What does Bernie Madoff know about the brain or about human weaknesses where he is able to take so many people and part them from their money?
Well, I think like every con artist, he was able to inspire confidence in people, a false confidence, and to get them to believe that they'd found an edge on the system. You know, if you're making 20% return on investment every year for 20 years, you should probably know, and you probably do know deep in your heart, that that's somehow not sustainable. Not to say that everyone who falls victim to a con is somehow crooked, although there is a famous con artist once said, you know, gyps and cons are all a case of the biter being bitten, which I kind of like. But, you know, I think that in a way he knew how to stoke people's confidence and to inflate their greed and get them to believe that they'd found a sure thing, an edge on the system. I think that term, sure thing, even originated with con artists and street hustlers. And I think, you know, he obviously had a position of authority, which helped. But again, it's very much the same idea. When you're playing a guy who plays a Monty thinks he can con the con artist, right? And I think, you know, Wall Street, well, you know, a lot of this stuff is basically, you know, it's based on perception. A lot of it is essentially, you know, manipulating people's greed and confidence and perception. You know, and a lot of it's a zero-sum game. So when someone thinks, oh, I can get an edge on this guy, you know, when you get greedy, that's, I think, when you're ripe to fall. And ultimately, it's the sucker's greed in the Monty that's his own demise.
I'm Kara Miller, and I'm talking to Alex Stone. His book is Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. And Alex Stone, has your sort of own moral compass changed since you've learned how to trick people? I mean, you said you have a grudging respect for the people who do the three-card Monty.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm not trying to glorify criminals. And these people are criminals, often ruthless people. But, you know, I mean, it's just the fact that they're very good at it. And you can't believe it when you watch a guy come around, you know, on his iPhone, someone who's like these aren't bumpkins that are being conned. I mean, they're regular people, otherwise intelligent people. I myself fell victim to the con when I was a kid. A lot of people have. It's a very powerful scam because it really does, it has this way of convincing you that you can win, and even though you know it's a con, and often the operator will feign ineptitude and, you know, in the way that like a bird, a mother bird will feign, you know, injury to protect her nestlings. And so, I guess just there's something to be said in the same way that watching, you know, a concert pianist perform well, or a good magician, you know, deceive people and put one over on someone. I think there's just an innate beauty to the elegance with which these very simple tools, these very rudimentary, grungy street tools can be used to trick someone. And, you know, as someone who likes magic and is interested in the psychology of deception, well, it's hard not to, in the same way that I've been pickpocketed before. And I remember the last time I pickpocketed was in Mexico City, and I didn't even notice it. And I was mad that I lost my wallet, but I have to admit, part of me said, well done, bravo. I didn't notice that. That was pretty good. Nice lift there, kid, you know, because it takes skill. And again, like, I'm not saying that you can condone it, but I don't know. You know, there's a certain elegance to it, and there's danger involved. And
well, the interesting thing, too, that you say is that cons go way beyond what we consider to be cons. And I think that's one of the interesting things. They're in infomercials, which make you believe something works so well. And then you get it home and you really can't figure out what's going on.
Every money-making scheme, every, you know, the diet books. I'm not saying all of this is BS, but I saw an infomercial recently about a guy, you know, I don't know, it was some using social networking to get rich. And the key is always, how does he explain why he wrote the book in the first place if he's already got this money-making secret, you know? And there's just a lot of deafness. Instead of switching the cards, you know, and misdirecting or bending one corner of the card and then unbending the other, well, he has a way of, you know, linguistically getting around this and pulling a switch and saying, oh, well, I wanted to help people, you know, or I wanted to do this, or something happened to me that caused a change in heart. And or whether it's, you know, the way people make up quotes and create false authority or stoke our insecurities, the way commercials, they're very deft and they're very sophisticated. It's showing a lifestyle that's slightly better than ours and making us feel ugly and, you know, poor and sad and lonely, and saying, well, if you can just buy this one product, you know, you can feel better. And you know, the way the three-card Monty guy will often throw out a veiled insult, you know, you got to have, you know, you don't have enough money to play, you know, hey, if you're going to be serious about this, you know, I'm not running a kid's show here, you know, this little veiled insult. So, that's kind of how it works, you know, in a lot of commercials. And we want to believe that we can find a solution to all of life's problems in a simple way. And so much of what we buy and what we do is geared towards that. You know, how many times have we convinced ourselves that we can get thin or rich or happier just by buying a book, that there's a secret, you know, the secret to happiness is somehow contained within a 200-page volume. It's a foible, but it's a very human one. And
well, interestingly, you say this sleight of hand extends into even, which I thought was interesting, the police department. So you talk about how speeding tickets are, in a way, a bit of a sleight of hand. How did you first discover that speeding tickets, which, I mean, they come from the government, seem completely legitimate? What about process is kind of a sleight of hand?
I'm really glad you asked that. You're actually the first person who's even asked me about that. There was a really great article in The New Yorker about the use of confidential informants in the war on drugs. It's a heartbreaking piece because they often exploit minors. They don't get due process. They're people who are arrested for petty drug offenses and then asked to set up these big-time criminals. And then many of them die and are murdered. And it's just horrible. Anyways, the reason I bring that up is because a lot of this is fueled by the fact that police departments often get to keep the assets that they seize during drug busts. Whether it's cars or guns or drugs. And there's been studies that have shown that when police departments, when law enforcement agencies are allowed to keep seized assets, the percentage of arrests, of drug arrests, the total arrests, almost doubles. This is also true with parking tickets, that government revenue falls short, like municipal government revenue falls short, the number of tickets issued increases. And this has happened in the recession. Legislation has been passed all over the place to increase ticketing, to put cameras up. Now, let me be clear. Speed limits are really important and good. Speeding is kills, like a lot of roadside fatalities are due to it. But when you have, for example, like the dozen or so smallest towns in Texas responsible for the majority of speeding tickets, that signals that maybe it's not all about public safety. There's this great story about this place, a town called New Rome, Ohio, that was the biggest speed trap in America at one point, made national news. I think the town had like 100 people in it, and there was a 12-man police force. They basically, it was just like the Monty, right? You know how in the Monty you switch one card for another?
Right.
Well, they would switch the speed up. So they'd have like a you know, the speed would go from 45 to 35 really quickly in a way that you didn't spot.
Right, you said it was a well-concealed sign, so people couldn't really tell.
And they raked in $500,000 a year from speeding tickets. And all that money was funneled back, or most of it was funneled back, into the police force. Finally, after years of running this con, a judge legally dissolved the town, citing rampant corruption. And so it no longer exists. Poof's gone. So yeah, it's speeding tickets are important. Speed's bad. But there are many instances in which it's motivated, and not just speeding, things like in the war on drugs. It's fed by economic imperatives, and that's bad in a lot of cases because it leads to people being exploited. And it, like this article points out, in the war on drugs can lead to, you know, horrible, horrible human rights violations, essentially is what they are. And people who got busted for having a quarter bag of weed, you know, getting killed by because they were forced into setting up, you know, a big-time kingpin. And so that's, and again, that's because there are these financial incentives, and that's something that's very important, like very, very bad.
Alex Stone's book is Fooling Houdini: Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. Alex Stone, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Ho, 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 it's magic.
And next week, we're back with a big question. How long can humans live? Breakthrough research on other animals may hold the key.
These little guys were just frisky, running around in their little broth, and they were actually living 10 times the lifespan of a normal worm. So this has been done, although worms aren't humans.
Remember that you can learn more about our guests or link to our podcasts at wgbh.org/innovationhub. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.
Music in my head.